From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for February 4th, 2011.
Each of us will have to struggle with our conscience and our constituencies as we hammer out a sensible plan to put our state on a sound fiscal footing, honestly balance our budget, and position California to regain its historic momentum.
That was Governor Jerry Brown in his State of the State speech on Monday night. I would call it his first speech, but that's kind of misleading.
His seventh.
I think he said it was his eighth, didn't he?
No. Did he say eighth? Maybe it was introduced as who knows?
We weren't here for all the rest of them.
No.
You and I were.
Neither was he.
Somewhere else. Neither was he. That's Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times. I'm John Myers from KQED. And so a big week, at least in terms of the debate outside of the Capitol, I would argue in a lot of ways, because, I mean, it was the governor's chance to make his case to the public, unfiltered, giving – we don't know how many people were listening and watching, but some.
I felt very smart in sort of an I told you so kind of way listening to the governor's speech.
Why is that?
Well, just his focus on the Democratic component of his budget plan, right, urging that
Democratic with a little d.
Small d, yeah. Right. But urging Republicans to give the people a right to vote, right? This is the same thing that they're all the clamor.
Invoking
in
Egypt
and Tunisia.
And Tunisia.
Right. Well, we could discuss that later.
Let's discuss it right now.
But this was the roadmap that was laid out by that PPIC poll, right? The 2/3 of voters, regardless of region, regardless of party, regardless of age, they want a chance to vote on this proposal.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And so the governor's speech kind of was the big element of the week. As we've gone forward here on the week, here we are at the end of the week. There have been – I did the count for a story that aired on Thursday morning. As of Thursday, and now if you actually add in Thursday, there have been 20, more than 20 hearings on different parts of the budget at the Capitol, budget subcommittee hearings on you name it. And so that process is cranking up and cranking forward, and an accelerated process because they're all trying to meet this deadline to get things on the ballot. But getting to the ballot is still the big dilemma,
right?
Politically,
between
Democrats and Republicans and the governor. So let's talk about the speech for a moment. I mean, my overall impression of the speech was that it was a very interesting maneuver he tried to pull off, whether he was successful, I don't know, of talking both to the public outside of the building and to the legislature there listening to the speech. Because, you know, we all always talk about these State of the State speeches. Who are they addressed at? And I guess you do that nationally as well, too. Are you talking to the people there in the audience? Or are you talking to the audience at home who's theoretically listening or watching?
Right.
And he seemed to be doing both. And he was trying very hard to couch it, you know, and the whole thing, as you said, appealing to them to be Democratic, small d. But I thought that was also geared toward the public, too, to put the pressure, perhaps, on Republicans who don't want to go along with the special election idea, you know, outside public pressure on them. So it was I don't know whether he pulled it off or not, but it was a twofer in a way.
Well, I mean, I agreed 100% with sort of who that message was aimed at in terms of you know, the first step is getting Republican votes. Before there can be a vote of the people, you need at least 4, perhaps 5 votes in the legislature. And so that is the first step in the campaign. And I think the big question, which nobody really knows how to answer, is who are the groups? What is the kind of pressure that might move Republican votes? Is it popular pressure? Is it pressure from interest groups? I mean, would sign-off from the Chamber of Commerce give Republicans enough cover? Would it be convincing John Kupal and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association? What is it that is going to allow Republicans to feel okay about voting for this proposal to put it on the ballot?
Well, I want to talk about for a minute about the way that it's all kind of played out so far because, and again, for the small number of people who listen to this podcast and do not know what we're talking about, what the Republicans would have to do is go along with Democrats in the majority to put a series of tax proposals on the ballot, an extension of taxes, additional tax revenues. We're going to get a semantics fight here again.
But, extension of sales and vehicle taxes and an increase in income taxes, I would say.
Yeah. Increase in income taxes because they have technically already gone down, though the statute that allowed them to be up hasn't expired, so anyway. That is far too technical, folks. But the Republicans have been reluctant would be a kind word, downright opposed to at least every Republican I've talked to, into putting those taxes on the ballot or putting them on the ballot without something else, which becomes part of the whole political trade-off about what else do we get if we're going to allow the voters to do this. But the way that this has been pushed out there in a PR perspective at the beginning here is that, and especially on Monday night too, we had Republicans, you know, basically saying, well, why do we want to do this? Why can't the legislature do its job? You know, and all, it was a very weird, I actually don't think it was a fully formed media strategy as to what their argument was. What was their counter? What was their reason for not doing it? I heard the voters have already voted. The legislature should do its own job. The governor hasn't even proposed a balanced budget.
And it's all the Democrats' problem.
And it's all the Democrats' problem. I mean, there were multiple strategies, which I think have a lot to do with the reaction they got in the press and the opinion writers around the state. And I don't know what actually starts to seep into the public's mind. Right. But what is their opposition based on? They're not entirely clear.
I think they're still struggling for a message. And I think in the meantime, while that sort of scrambling to find a message is happening, Brown is trying to smoke them out a little bit and put some pressure on them. You know, there are some policy retreats or huddles or meetings of the two Republican groups, the cocci next week.
The two caucuses.
Yes.
The cocci.
And perhaps a more coherent and coordinated media strategy will evolve from that, or perhaps not. I don't know. But I think that, you know, Brown is trying to make a common sense rationale for why they should put up these votes. And there are a lot of different opinions from Republicans about why they shouldn't, but they do appear unified in one thing, and that's that they don't want to put up these votes, at least not right now.
Yeah, and so when you look at the governor's speech, there was a lot of that, as we already mentioned, but let's circle back quickly, the small d, you know, the democratic system, and invoking Egypt and Tunisia. Talk about that for a moment. I don't know what to say about that, except that there was some initial anger from some Republicans that they had been put into this corner that equated them with what's going on overseas by their reluctance. I don't know. I mean, you know, some will say it was a little heavy-handed by the governor. Some say right on. See, I mean, and I don't know. But it was an interesting choice. It was not a safe choice, I would say, to equate it to that in some ways.
Right. What the lasting impacts of that are.
Small.
You know, I think the larger point is Brown's point of, hey, you guys don't like this plan, come up with another proposal.
Yeah.
And the only thing that came out of it, best I could tell, was, well, maybe we should vote for tax cuts too. I mean,
yeah, we got this discussion here midweek, started right by John Kopal, right, at the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association.
And Nathan Fletcher mentioned it as well.
Nathan Fletcher, assembly member, Republican from San Diego. Mm-hmm. This idea that, okay, if we put a series of tax increases/extensions on the ballot, let's put right beside it a series of tax cuts on the ballot, which, of course, assuming that the voters, no one likes to be taxed, will say, yes, let's cut our taxes.
Well, hey, and look, if they want to present a balanced budget with tax cuts in it, then yeah. I'm sure the governor would listen to it.
Governor quickly dismissed it as flim-flam in a radio interview from the Bay Area, and Democrats in the legislature, you know, called it preposterous, you know, as well. But again, it goes back to what will make Republicans comfortable, if anything, to agree to the special election idea? What do they want? Do they want pension reform? Do they want regulatory relief? I mean, those have all been bandied about, right? What is it that makes them comfortable, if anything? Meanwhile, I don't want to put too much of that clock mentality out there, but that clock is ticking. We're here first week of February, depending on who you talk to, first week, second week, third week of March. I could make a case for even later, but I won't quite yet.
Right.
There's not a tremendous amount of time.
No. And, you know, we'll see if this can come off from June. I mean, you know, you alluded to the subcommittee hearings that are going on in the legislature now. If you look there, it's that, you know, none of the big cuts proposed by the governor are being adopted by these subcommittees. And so there's this sort of you go first, no, you go first mentality that's taken place where, you know, Republicans say they want to see some real cuts, and then they will consider possibly having this discussion. Not that they'll vote for it, but they want to see, you know, what they characterize as an act of good faith from the Democrats on the cut side. The Democrats aren't there yet.
And I was going to say, let's talk about this specifically. I mean, because we want to be fair, this is they're two dance partners in this whole process. And on the Democratic side, you're still hearing we support where the governor's going, but we also reserve the right to look at where the cuts are versus other cuts.
Right.
You heard that again in not so many words from Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg when he was asked about it on Wednesday at a press conference on an unrelated subject. You had some people characterize Speaker Perez's statement after the State of the State as not a full-throated endorsement of where the governor's headed. All of that atmospheric set aside for a moment, you do have a lot of real questions about these cuts. I mean, you are watching, as we've unfortunately seen every year recently, but you're watching a tremendous number of people come up and show real pain and emotion and life and death, as they would say, at situations from some of these cuts and some of the ways that the governor is balancing the budget. And you are going to get Democrats who say, okay, well, let's not cut it from there. Let's cut it from here. But when is that going to happen?
Right. And what is the political calculation associated with that? I mean, do you get to a point where you lose some Democrats because of the cuts that are being proposed? Even if it's sort of the basic framework of this 12 and 12 billion, and we understand there are problems with those numbers, but roughly those are the governor's numbers. But can you hold the Democrats together? I mean, especially
when... And if you can't, you're going to need that many more Republican votes to get this package out.
Right. And the Democrats, you have people like Sondre Swanson, Democrat from Oakland, talking about wanting to do more on the revenue side and less with cuts. You have people like Leland Yee, a senator from San Francisco, who's running for mayor of San Francisco, didn't vote for the budget last time because he thinks voting for cuts is a bad political vote for his next job. You have this strange dynamic where none of these people know the district in which they're running in. It won't be August until we see the new districts from the Redistricting Commission. And so some people think it might be August because once there's a little more clarity on the political side, that might ease the pathway, or at least add some clarity to the political decisions that all these people are making in the legislature. And so, look, these decisions are not happening in a vacuum. It's very complicated. And, I sure hope there's progress behind the scenes, because publicly it doesn't look like we're at the point now that we can say there's tangible progress on the budget.
I want to switch to a policy thing for a moment, because, there's no way to completely tease out policy from politics and vice versa. But a policy hearing that I sat in, one of these budget hearings that I sat in, was this realignment discussion that happened on Wednesday in front of the new Senate Governance Committee, where the whole discussion of the governor's plan to shift control from the state to counties of a myriad of services, public safety issues, child welfare issues, court
mental
security,
health,
firefighting, mental health. That's almost the whole list.
Right.
About $6 billion worth of spending in the budget to come, paid for with the car tax and sales tax extensions. And talk about a policy thicket, trying to understand how all of that would work, trying to understand what the long-term funding is, because one of the things that has been talked about but I think is worth highlighting again here is that the only funding the governor has identified for that shift are the taxes, which are only a five-year deal.
Right.
He has not identified, nor has his advisors, they admitted it, Diane Cummins and others in the hearing, they don't know for sure what year six, year seven, year 20 looks like of how you pay for that. Is it earmarked money out of the general fund after that? And then what's the ramifications of earmarking more of the general fund that's already bleeding money?
And at what level is it earmarked? Does it cover what they call caseload growth?
Yeah.
As these programs have to cater to more and more people, is that increase covered by the state, or is it just this base level and any increase has to somehow come out of the county or city budget?
And is the state willing, one more policy thicket, is the state willing to hand over largely the money in mass and say, counties, use it the best way you want, or do they want to be more specific about it, which is what they did in 1991 under the realignment plan, and their pros and cons to that path. So these are all really complicated policy issues, and it came back in this hearing, and Anthony and I were talking about it before the podcast started. This has to go to the ballot as well. Because, and that was something that I don't know if it's been terribly clear, but it came out of the hearing on Wednesday, that a lot of the changes in the state-local relationship are things that have to be amended into the state constitution. They change the existing thing, the voters. So the voters have to ratify part of that. They have to ratify taxes. They have to ratify a redirection of tobacco tax funds.
Right.
The ballot gets more and more complicated.
And suddenly you start running into the political problem that they had in 2009, where there were six different measures as part of the special election. And at some point, voters look at it, throw up their hands and say, what is this mess? Why am I being asked to do this? You guys go figure it out. I think that was part of the problem. 2009, anybody who was involved in that campaign would tell you there were a lot of problems. But one of the problems was that it was confusing. You had redirection of mental health money, redirection of tobacco money. You had a spending cap. You had a recalculation of the Prop 98 formula. You had, you know, some gratuitous punishment for lawmakers, and you know, and then you had securitization of the lottery. I mean, what are voters supposed to do with that? You know, and
it became too hard to sell as a package, and it became very easy to knock down as a package.
Right, and Brown's political team is aware of that; they're cognizant of that, and yet some of this stuff is unavoidable, and it alludes to some of the knots that we've tied ourselves in over the year. I thought George Skelton had a great column in the LA Times today.
Thursday.
Right. you know, referring to what he called a bloated constitution, which is true. That's exactly what the state has. It's that, you know, there's so much policy that the constitution is not the way that we think of, say, the U.S. Constitution, where it really is a framing document and has, you know, some general sort of abstract rights, you know, that it codifies into law. But a lot of policy details in California are handled through the Constitution, and it makes it very complicated to change, makes it very complicated to fix, and without some voter involvement. I mean, part of the, I mean, we're talking about the realignment proposal. It's not long before you start knocking up against Prop 13, right? Because Prop 13 made it, I mean, implicit in this whole discussion of realignment is that if you want to increase funding for this stuff in the future, it's going to have to happen on a county-by-county basis. And guess what? Prop 13 in 1978 made it harder for counties to raise taxes for specific programs. And so this conversation about government, and the governor has been very deliberate in not wanting to be seen as attacking Prop 13 in any way, although you can argue that some of his redevelopment proposal, you know, does actually tweak Prop 13. But that perhaps that's down the road a little.
But I was going to mention redevelopment in a different light and then get it to a larger point that we could sit and BS about for a moment. And that is the biggest first flashpoint, and continues to be a big flashpoint, and will be again next week when more hearings are scheduled on this proposal, is this plan to abolish redevelopment agencies. Because it got the ire of cities across the state. We had a pretty heated exchange at the Sacramento Press Club on Tuesday about it from the president of the State Redevelopment Association and Assemblymember Chris Norby, a Republican from Orange County, who has been a longtime critic of redevelopment. Anyway, that is another mess that we haven't even addressed here in addition to all the other things. And here's the point that I was going to let us BS on for a moment, and that is, the obvious way to look at all of this would be, it seems like to me, that, you know, Governor Brown and his team are putting out 1,400 fires at once, or fighting 1,400 or however many fights at once.
Or beginning to dismantle the state firefighting agency. How about that?
Yeah, strange. dismantle. See, now.
Well, another
depends
podcast
on who you talk to.
Right.
But trying to do too many things at once, and that is a major problem, and the whole thing could collapse. On the other hand, could you not make a point that that actually works to his advantage at a certain point, because everybody is unsettled? You know, maybe he's hoping to unsettle the entire normal process here and find out what shakes out of that at the back end. Plus, it also maybe does it not help sell to the public, look, I have no sacred cow here. I'm pissing off this person and that person and that person and that person. I'm not protecting anybody.
Right. And yet, how do you do that and maintain everybody's skin in the game in terms of having a stake in having whatever proposal shakes out of this, making sure that that passes and having that be in everyone's vested interest? I mean, that's challenging. That's very challenging. And right. I mean, some of the realignment things, for example, I mean, the firefighters, just take the firefighters. They hate the redevelopment agencies. They love the governor's plan to get rid of the redevelopment agencies because
the money goes back to local programs like...
Well, like goes into the general funds of cities and counties, yeah, which is what pays firefighters' salaries and pensions.
Right.
But on the realignment proposals, I mean, there's a proposal to really scale back what the state firefighters do. And so so there are some concerns there. And that's why I think Brown wants to present this as one comprehensive package. I mean, I think some of those political considerations were taken into account that, hey, these people are going to like this piece, but they're not going to like this piece. I mean, the redevelopment piece was seen as a nod in some ways to conservatives like Assemblyman Norby, who have had a problem for years with redevelopment agencies. Although, you know, it's sort of angered some Democrats in big cities. There are other pieces of the proposal that cities like. So this is complicated. This is complicated to try to do all in one shot, try to build a coalition in the legislature and then try to sell it to voters. And in, you know, 28 days or whatever it is. So,
yeah. And those are the other two things I wanted to make sure we talked about. Because you referenced George Skelton's column in the LA Times that appeared on Thursday. And the other part of that column that I think is worth talking about for a moment, if folks didn't read it, is that George not only takes Republicans to task for this, avoidance of a special election, and right, as we've already said, what's their message? Why?
Right.
But he takes the governor to task as well.
And
I do think this is one of the things we will look back on no matter how this shakes out, is because the governor made a political calculation in his campaign that taxes had to be approved by voters. I'm sure it polled well, it tested well, it sells well, it makes it seem like, you know, I'm not a Democrat who's going to raise taxes, right? But because he made that calculation months ago in the campaign for governor, we are now in a process where we are hurtling toward a really early deadline, a very different dynamic, because we're trying to make a ballot in time for a July 1st on-time budget.
Well, and as hard as it is, I mean, it's hard to know politically whether that pledge gives some cover to Republicans who may end up putting up votes to at least put this before voters. But it certainly makes it harder. It creates another obstacle to having any tax increases enacted or extensions, whatever you want to call them. But, I mean, even if you can get the four votes.
I always think of hair extensions with tax extensions.
There
but
you go.
That's a
George Clinton tax extensions.
Britney Spears?
No. Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Where were we?
You were saying it another obstacle about for the
ballot. Yeah, it's that once you get those four votes, you have to go sell it to voters. And I think there's a lot of people, there's a certain strain of conventional wisdom here that says, yeah, they'll probably get this thing on the ballot, and then it'll probably collapse and be rejected anyway, right? I mean, we've all heard that bet being laid down, you know, that and if that happens, if that is that scenario indeed plays out, a lot of us in the chin stroking and 2020 hindsight business will go back and point back to that pledge that Brown made as a real obstacle for what he wants to achieve as governor.
I've just come up with a name for my consulting business.
2020 hindsight?
Oh, chin strokers, but
oh,
yeah,
okay.
Either one.
Okay.
2020 hindsight is great. Yeah. You know, with my drop line being, we always get it right.
There you go.
There you go. The other thing I wanted to talk about, man, that was random. The other thing I wanted to make sure we talked about, that I thought it was a good piece of reporting by an occasional podcast contributor, Kevin Yamamura from the Sacramento Bee, that I think also was a story that they ran on Thursday.
Yes.
Losing track of my days. Was Democrats in the legislature now have some things to consider, one of them being, do we just go ahead and come up with a $25 billion cut package?
And we talked about that last week.
But I think it's a great dynamic here to talk about, because if in fact they did that, because you know we're all sitting here trying to figure out where the other $12 billion would come from, and we all know politics aside, the way the policy works and what you can't. Well, we don't all know this, but what you can and can't do.
You there listening on the couch, you don't know what we're talking about.
But they listen on the couch?
That's the guy I'm talking about,
oh,
yes.
That guy, you.
Yeah.
Get up. You know, there's certain things that can't be cut. You can't cut some things because you've got federal mandates about some social programs.
Well, they could be eliminated.
Well, okay, perhaps. but you're constrained there somewhat.
Right.
You are constrained with prison funding because if for no other reason, the public will not accept massive release of prisoners.
Well, and the federal government. I mean, the prisons are also in federal receivership.
Well, yeah, so. Healthcare issues, yeah. Right, are dealt with there. Education, you're constrained by Prop 98, maybe, depending on how that's crafted and votes in the legislature. So, you know, you start to see where you cut. I mean, education, you cut. Higher ed, you cut. Whatever, and on and on and on. And so now you get back to this both policy and political calculation of, don't we just go ahead and figure out what that is? And then some people are going to say, well, that's crass politics. You're trying to scare the voters. But what is the—
I think I read that in the LA Times on Sunday, didn't I?
I think, yeah, by a guy named, I'm stroking my chin, Anthony York. But I do find it a fascinating discussion, just briefly. Is that scaring the voters or is that being honest with the voters? And
yes.
I don't know the answer to this. I mean, you know, that's not my job to say that. You know, people say, oh, this is a tactic. But at a certain point, I mean, isn't there a need to be honest with how we get it?
Well, I think, you know, you can't, again, another thing you can't consider in a vacuum because remember the last couple of budgets from Arnold Schwarzenegger? I mean, they were these doomsday scenarios. We've been told the sky is falling for years in Sacramento. And, you know, Schwarzenegger puts out these doomsday budgets and says, we have to do this. We have to close all the state parks and eliminate welfare, right? And these things never come to pass. And so I do think that there is a problem with the all-cuts approach and that there's a desensitization of voters, right? I think that's part of what's being dealt with here. The other thing is that for this plan to pass politically, I think Jerry Brown needs to be the spokesman. He needs to be the one who is seen as, and I think he's done a pretty good job so far in terms of positioning himself to be the spokesman who has the authority, the integrity, and the honesty to be quote-unquote leveling with people about how things really are.
Track record, everything.
And so if he's seen as trying to scare people, it undermines that ability of him to be a truth teller during the campaign, a straight talker. And so,
in which case the legislature does that,
well,
and then he just says what
right.
the legislature
says. That's what's happening, right? I've asked the legislative analyst whether or not anybody has... I'm looking at you, Mark Leno, Senator, Budget Chairman from San Francisco. Whether or not anybody has actually asked the LAO to prepare a contingency, an all-cuts, quote-unquote, contingency. And I'm sure it's happening. I think we said this last week. I mean, this will be part of the debate. This will be... But this contingency will be in print. It will fall into the hot little hands of some enterprising reporter, and it will be something that is discussed during this debate, and it will not have the governor's fingerprints on it. Now, I'm not saying that the governor secretly wants this to be out there, but I think that they wouldn't mind having it be part of the discussion. They just need to keep their fingerprints off of it. And so I get the sense that there's sort of a wink and a nod and a tacit, hey, we're okay with this if this plan sees the light of day. And I think that's where we're headed the next week or two.
But I don't even – and that's a good analysis. But I would say also – I mean, you could also say that it's not even that subterranean because the governor continues to say, as he said in the State of the State, you got other ideas? Bring them to me.
Right.
You want to do all cuts? Bring them to me. And, I mean, he's opening the door for people to show him that and to bring that to light.
But whether that becomes a focus of his political strategy and his political, you know, campaigning, and I mean campaign in the broad sense, both internally in the legislature and whatever external campaign there may or may not be later, that will be interesting to see.
Yeah.
As well.
And I guess we end this by saying that, you know, we don't know where it's going and we are on a short time frame and people will look back and say, did the governor make some decisions that made this harder, worse, better, you know, about the promise of the taxes and the vote and everything else. At the same time,
John's getting his legacy piece ready for 2014.
Yeah, exactly right. Let me write it all down now.
2015, right.
But at the same time, ooh, you've only said he's only going to be a one-term governor.
Did I say that?
Yeah, that's what it sounded like.
Hmm.
But I guess the broader picture is he only had so many options coming into office. I mean, therein lies part of the problem with all of this. Is, and I'm not defending the governor. I'm not being his cheerleader here. I think he's made a few decisions that have made this a lot harder, and the election certainly seems to be one of them. But
he did
anybody
win
who won, anybody who won, choices would have been limited here. Meg Whitman, yes. Jerry Brown, the Libertarians, the Greens, choices would have been limited.
Yes.
And therein lies the problem with all of this. Yes.
Yes.
I agree.
Yes, choices are limited.
Choices are limited.
That's the name of my furniture store.
Choices are limited. Time is running out. Operators are standing by. And by the way,
some assembly required.
Yeah, by the way, this is a bad plug, but it is pledge week at KQED. So if you would, say this. Hey, look, they pay my salary. Okay. My kids need daycare.
Okay.
If you'd like to make a pledge, go online, kqed.org. You can make one. It supports even our little programs like the podcast. We don't pay Anthony much, but an occasional beer at the bar is better than none.
You did cover that. Thank you.
Don't tell the bosses that. That's Anthony York from the LA Times, or your bosses. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.